We are all motivated by meaning, which is why the Reinvent podcast aims to bring you a wide range of relevant information, focusing on all aspects of physical, mental, and spiritual well-being. The objective of this show is to pick the minds of some of the most interesting people, all with their own stories of personal transformation, so that you can make the changes towards a more meaningful, healthier, and happier life. My name is Nikki Robertson. I'm a clinical nutritionist, NLP practitioner, and founder of Reinvent Health. In this episode, former Naval Officer Roy Henderson had a vision of feeding the world's most impoverished populations. Now a successful entrepreneur and CEO of Green Cell Technologies, a company that is innovating the way food is manufactured and distributed, potentially safeguarding food security for future generations.
I came across your article on LinkedIn, yes. Independent online article, and it was, you know, for people in the food industry or in the conscious consumerism industry, this is what we've been talking about for years. But what we have found ourselves in now is a situation where big brands, big manufacturers may have to start thinking differently about how they make food, how they create solutions for people who don't have a lot of money. The way we manufacture and distribute is going to have to change. So I really just want your thoughts and where you are. First, let's chat about what Green Cell is and what you do.
Well, Green Cell Technologies is a company that we established. Well, it's been long coming. It's got to the final iteration of Green Cell now, where we started off in a pure research and development process of trying to perfect extraction predominantly for the nutraceutical industry, but we soon realized that any time you take a whole material and you break that open, it de facto is an extraction. A fruit juice is an extraction, whatever the case may be. And we found that the extractions of today are quite inefficient insofar as at the end of each extraction process, be it for a particular medical or nutraceutical or cosmeceutical application, for an agricultural application, or for food and beverage, there's a big pile of waste. And that pile of waste typically represents your skins and seeds predominantly. And that typically represents just about all the important phytochemistry that you require. Now it's not nice eating an orange skin, but let's face it, on the pure science of it, if you were to eat that orange skin, you'd be a lot healthier than where you'd eat the rest of the orange, as a simple example. So we found that extraction was quite inefficient. And we also found that that if you look at extraction, it's either squeezing something really hard or spinning a blade really fast. And that hasn't changed since the Industrial Revolution started. The only thing that's happened now is they've taken these equipments, they've obviously become technologically advanced, so they put in it in a shinier box, they slap in a computer onto it, but it still is squeezing something and spinning a blade. And the net result is at the end of each day, there's a big pile of waste. So we researched and developed this and found that what we were after was really the contents of those cells, be they meat cells for those people who are inclined, or be they for vegetable or fruit cells for those people who aren't so inclined. And we were to harvest that with the fiber broken down at the same time to such a way that you haven't got to literally mange your way through a wheelbarrow of food every single day. You are going to then have a high return on your phytochemistry or the goods that you find in the cell structures, and you're going to have a very manageable fiber if we could find a way of extracting or breaking these things apart more efficiently. So Green Cell Technology went from research and development to an engineering phase where they developed and have now patented, and in fact is in global patent application pending in some places, granted in others. A piece of technology called the disruptor, which allows us without squeezing and without spinning a blade, a way of breaking anything, skin, seeds, stalks, the little leaves on top of the stalks, it doesn't matter, apart to a very, very small sized particle size. I mean, you know, not to get too technical in that respect, but typically everything is sub 100 micron, which is really, really small because the industry standard at the moment is to break it to 500 micron and it's still quite coarse and gritty. And that means that you have a piece of equipment that can break the materials down and they can be manipulated into end products. And that's what Green Cell does.
So what was it that got you motivated into speaking about, let's talk about that article that you wrote and put out there on the Independent Online, because for, like I said before, for a lot of us, this is the way that food manufacturing has to go. We've seen companies like Whole Foods, who started off as micro organizations. It was four guys who started a company literally in their backyard, and it was bought out by Amazon. It's one of the biggest food companies in the world. How do you think a company like that could stick with its ethic of providing good quality, ethically sustainable foods for millions of people? Is it possible in this day and age? I mean, I think it's possible, but it's going to have to take a big change from the attitudes of the big food manufacturers, and that's hard work.
What you've got is a balance between capitalism in its truest form and conscious capitalism. And if we can get that balance right, then your answer is simple. Yes, it will hold. Whilst the almighty buck holds sway over everyone's considerations and thoughts, we unfortunately fall prey to shareholders before we fall prey to consumers. There's so many things that you can tie in here. Just look at this latest situation with COVID. Because there was a little bit of death involved, the attitude of people changed very quickly. We didn't have to beg people to stand in a line 2 meters apart and wait to go into the shop. It happened automatically. Why? Because there was a punishment on the other end of that if they didn't do it, or a possibility of a punishment. When you've got people that hold sway over many more people, i.e. capitalists, they're rich, they're influential, and they probably are more worried about the money than the person themselves, you're going to end up with no one, them not wanting to follow. But if they suddenly can't have that money, they will fall in line. So it's a carrot and stick, which is such a terrible thing in life that we have to get to cane someone in order for them to comply. But that, unfortunately, is the nature of the beast. So if we can provide a solution where you don't have where you have reward, and also while you're about it, just a benefit to the environment, and while you're about it, you can earn money, you're going to have conscientious capitalism. And at the moment, processing ability to manufacture food is limited, as we described a little bit earlier, which means that until something else comes along, and something else has just come along now, you're going to have people relying on what they know, and that means they're going to try and eke every dollar and cent out of their process on old equipment, which means that their ability to be conscientious is limited. So having said that, let's look at the Whole Foods example. The beauty about companies like Whole Foods, and there are many of them now, that are there's the Whole Foods company, there's other companies that are trying to challenge the whole vegan, not vegan, the plant-based thing, et cetera, et cetera. If you look at those companies, they are the great innovators of the world. They're the people that are maverick. They get out there. They're not scared to go and try and challenge the status quo and make a difference in the world. The problem is that eventually they grow. Big companies, the blue chip companies that are the food and beverage companies of the world, say, hey, we're too scared to make decisions. We've got shareholders to satisfy. We're going to lose our job if we make a decision that might actually bounce back at us. So what we're going to do, we're going to buy that company. And we're going to buy that company to show that we're innovative. And that company, under the wing of the dragon, gets bigger and bigger till eventually they get so big, when someone says to them, gee, let's see if we can make orange bananas, they're not going to do it. They become less innovative and they fall by the wayside and they become their masters. So that is the risk when money gets into it, or when corporate structure gets involved in anything that starts out a good idea. If that happens, eventually they will fall prey to shareholders. So again, it comes back to the conscientious side. If they are able to make their money, if they are able to have the lifestyles that they've aspired to, but at the same time, the side or the byproduct is not waste. The byproduct is in fact saving the environment and giving consumers valuable food. Then you're going to have the ability for capitalists to be conscientious. And when they are conscious of conscientious and conscious of their surroundings and of what they're doing, then at the end of the day, you will allow a Whole Foods style company. And I can't speak for them. I'm using them loosely, to be able to be ethical, no matter what size they are.
So I think, you know, what we've been through in the last the first quarter of this year with the outbreak of the virus is, you know, firstly, people are being more aware firsthand that what they eat becomes who they are. It directly impacts the immune system. And a lot of people know this on a theoretical level. Now we're seeing it demonstrated. We're seeing it demonstrated in high definition in our faces every single day. And the data that's coming out is showing that people who have foundational health are more resistant. Their immune systems learn quicker. And this is nothing new for anybody who is a nutritionist, a naturopath, somebody who goes out and manufactures more ethically raised food. So it has been a kind of a strange and morbid blessing in disguise, because it has been almost the fulcrum that has forced us into thinking differently. And again, yes, the big food manufacturers are going to be very hard to sway, but bottom line is consumers will vote with their wallets. And for me, the big pivot here is consumer education. If we can get this through to the average person that firstly, it shouldn't cost you more money to eat well. It's going to save you a fortune in healthcare. It is going to increase the quality of your life, and it may even give you a job. This is the magic potential that we could bring from this experience.
With the virus being as rampant as it has been, farming has been culled. In South Africa, we know directly, we have dealt directly with farmers who have literally let their crops rot on the vine or on the trees, or they've picked them because the weight of the fruit actually breaks the branches, and they've ploughed it straight back into the land. Now that is absolutely sacrosanct in a place like South Africa. If you go to other countries that are a little more affluent and what have you, that might not be so sacrosanct. But there are things that are not on the shelf. We deal with the market, the Epping market, for example, in Cape Town. It doesn't have any root and vegetable because it's battling to find, because farmers can't produce. So it definitely has had an effect on the distribution channels. But I think before we can see how this could influence big corporate food to change their viewpoint, we kind of need to understand why it is that we eat. And once upon a time, a few hundred years ago, we had to hunt and gather. That was all we had to do. We didn't have, we ate to live. Now suddenly eating has become an event. And so now we live to eat, and the foods that are produced and put onto our shelves have changed so dramatically, as well as the farming. I mean, we grow apples and oranges, again, using them as a silly example, to have more sugar in them now so that we can make fruit juices more yield-bearing. But the problem is that you are now getting so much extra sugar in there, and sugar, we know, is not necessarily the healthiest thing to be chomping down in massive amounts. So we've skewed our supply, we've skewed our usage, to the point that we've got all these modern day maladies which have joined us, such as heart disease, obesities, and diabetes, and so on and so forth, which, as you say, is making us more vulnerable to things like the virus. So we have to push a button to reset all of what is going on with regards to the food that we eat. So companies need to stop making sweet sugary cookies and start making something which is a bit healthier. But again, I hate to keep on banging on this drum, but whilst it is earning an income for them, and whilst it is the only thing they know, that's not going to change in a rush. But the one great thing about the human nature is that we have shown that when we have a common goal, that we can stand together. And provided we can stand together, because we can't rely on government, we can't rely on businesses whilst they don't see the path forward. We as the consumer, with government and with our business people, our business leaders, need to educate each other and push ahead and push them over the edge so they can actually come to a point where they decide, hey, we're going to do something different with the way we manufacture food. We can't rely on just one party going to do it. We can't sit back and say, okay, they'll do it. We can't do that anymore. We buy, therefore, we have the power. And they manufacture, and if they don't manufacture, they have the power. So there's a symbiosis there that we need to find a balance for. We need to have them make us healthy things And we need to make sure that they're making it in such a way that it doesn't damage this blue marble that we spin through the universe on. But at the same time, we need to also make sure that they are able to make their money, because they are the job people, and give us the food we want. So I think if we can find that balance, then that'll push them over the edge for them to be able to see a way forward with the right kind of technology, the right kind of processes, with the right kind of farming across the entire value chain, so that at the end of the day, we can get to a point where they see the way to make money, they see the way to give you what you want, and we can all benefit from it.
So in your industry, you must have seen a lot of window dressing in your time I've seen it a hell of a lot, where companies, some of our biggest food chains in this country, dress up food to look healthier, take a lot of processed food and put a leaf on the label, and the consumer assumes that it must be organic or good for you because it's in green. To what extent do you see this? I know that label legislation is non-existent, or the follow-up on label legislation. Nobody goes and checks unless there's a formal complaint. I think this is a big problem, and I think it's something that people like yourself, me, you know, anybody who is trying to educate people should be tackling. What do you think about that?
Yeah, labels are a double-edged sword. I mean, they're there to inform as well as there to be part of a legislative process in order that they can put their products on the shelf. At least people are far more educated now, and if they're not, they've got something at shorthand called a phone, and they can Google. And a lot of them are putting, you know, QC codes and all the rest of it. So you can actually go and click that, and you'll see a whole history. The problem is that there's language in those labels that although at face value seem to say the right thing, if you understand what that language is, you realize it's not necessarily the right thing. I think the way food has morphed over the last few years, and pretty much since about the 70s, where things like World Health Organizations and all of the other governing authorities on the food and beverage process have had some say or sway over food manufacture, we found that we've moved away from fat and back to fat, and away from sugar and back to sugar, and away from sugar, and so on and so forth. And all of that has meant that there is an imbalance in the food that's been manufactured, represented by the label, which has all these health benefits or not benefits, but whilst the language on the label isn't fully understood by the consumer, you are going to have people giving with the perception, and I can't and don't want to mention brands here, but there are some brands that have got food that has been dressed up, as you say, it is super healthy looking, but when you actually read and understand the label, it's not, and it's not going to change whilst at the end of the day they need to pay salaries and rent and all these other things and their mortgage, and they are going to put something out there within the letter of the law that can be addressed or can be gotten away with in order to make people for sale. So that you've got advertising which will drape whatever picture on top of that's going to make people want to buy it, but really at the end of the day, once you undress that product, what's inside it can be challengeable in many respects. And again, if it's not only they are manufacturing for us, the consumer, and we can't accept what they are manufacturing as what it is for now. It's bad food. It's poor food in some respects. Some is good, to be fair. But if we don't push back and let them realize that we don't want this food from them anymore, then the label is actually immaterial. We're buying it still. But the only way that's going to happen is if we change our eating habits. So really, to complain about the label is one thing, but we should be complaining about the food. If people realize that what they are eating is not really healthy, and they say, hey, I want it to be healthier, and this is how we can achieve it, then the manufacturer will know to manufacture that kind of food. So yeah, we can't have a sweet tooth and then put, you know, expect them to take the sugar out.
Yeah, we're complicit in this situation because we're enabling. It's like enabling any abusive relationship. If you let that behavior continue, it's not going to change. So it is up to us, the consumer, to learn. And the information is freely available to anybody, even with a rudimentary internet connection, to go out there and educate themselves if it's important to you. And that's always the deciding factor when it comes to behavior change.
The thing of it is that it's easy for people that are of an ability to be able to jump on the internet quickly. The bigger concern I have or that worries me is that we've got a grouping of people which are not necessarily enabled. And that, whether they have access to the internet or not, I mean, most people have a smartphone nowadays, doesn't mean that they can automatically understand what they're reading. And these people tend to be our more custodial people. And they are arguably the people that need better health and nutrition and energy levels, because this is about energy transfer, than the person sitting behind a computer all day. So quite frankly, it's in a form of abuse when we are giving a foodstuff, which is a cheap foodstuff because that's what they can afford. And that cheap foodstuff is of such a nature that they can't actually derive proper nutritional benefit from it. And then we expect them to dig and pick and what have you, and clean and all the rest of it for hours on end. It's a form of abuse as far as I'm concerned.
No, absolutely. It always breaks my heart to watch a car guard or a security person sitting there and throwing back their 2-liter Coke and their white loaf of white bread. You know, it kills me because we're not helping anybody by letting that happen. But give them a choice. There's lots of, I shop at Jackson's quite a lot. And Gary's done this experiment with his staff where they priced the cost of a 2-liter Coke and a loaf of white bread and made a nutritious equivalent using chicken livers and spinach and things that were organically grown. And it did not cost 1 cent more. But it's educating the palate. And also, this is a cultural thing. You know, if it fills the tummy and it boost the serotonin, that's what we're going to go for. And just finding a way to explain to a person at the level of where they're at so that they understand they don't have to get sick if they change or include more of these good things in their diet. Not even initially to the exclusion of what they naturally would go for, but just to start including the good stuff. And very soon the brain starts to go, wow, I feel better when I have more protein or more green vegetables. And eventually the learning starts to override the habits. But it's going to, like you said, it's going to have to be at a level and an accessibility where people can grasp this information. And it's going to have meaning. Otherwise, we're not going to break through this. And it is terribly disturbing to watch because you just know what's going on biomechanically when somebody exposes them to themselves over and over again.
Yes.
So yeah, you mentioned earlier about the origin of your company and using the whole food, breaking down the cells, for example, the skins. And as in nutrition, we talk about the rind of a lemon being nature's chemotherapy because there's such strong phytochemicals in that skin that it literally breaks down cells that are not healthy or gets rid of them, helps the body to detoxify and eliminate them. So when we look at processed food, there are huge amounts of chemicals, shelf stabilizers, things that keep color vibrant, stop the taste from going bad, stopping products that stop juices, for example, from foaming or fermenting. And I know, and you know, that what is contained in that skin, those oils, do this anyway. Wouldn't it be cheaper for a food manufacturer to not spend money on these chemicals and instead use the whole product? Or would that mean changing an entire production line and cost more money in the end?
It absolutely does mean that they can do it, and it does mean that there are natural ways of doing it. But having said that, they have a product which has been through a process, a development process, a stability process, et cetera, in order that they know that it's not going to harm anyone in its format other than the obvious harm over time. But the problem to change that is not necessarily the cost. I mean, that they're doing anyway. Product development is ongoing. the problem is going to be that they've got to get to a point before they can sell it that they know that they're going to be able to make money on it. And that is probably more the consumer at fault than the developer or the manufacturer. They will manufacture a product that they know the consumer wants. The consumer buys it, they continue buying it, they continue making it. The way to get these natural things in play and all the rest of it and is the education of the consumer. So they need to stop wanting sweet things or whatever the case things and all these. And if they want something natural, you don't need to put gums in. You can use the fiber of the material. We know this, but that means there has to be a shift on the part of the consumer, because then the manufacturer will be allowed to follow. Whilst the consumer doesn't push the manufacturer to follow, the manufacturer will keep on churning what they know is giving them sales every single day.
So in your opinion, who are the movers and shakers in the South African food manufacturing arena, who are possibly putting more time and effort into developing products that are really good for you? Or is that not even on the horizon yet?
It's a very difficult question to answer that, because I think that there are a lot of food producers that are who produce specifically for the retail industry or specifically for a particular outlet, and you get certain retail brands that will go to them and say, give me this, and it's a bog standard tomato sauce or whatever the case may be, where no one's going to necessarily challenge that. And there are some consumers, retailers, should I say, that are trying to come up with legitimate, better quality products. But it does come down to value chain analysis. And the minute you start using that word value chain analysis, Norris, you're talking about rands and cents. And when you're talking about rands and cents, you're talking about shareholder interests. So it is very difficult when a pure scientific approach to product development is taken and they come up with this beautiful product that's about as natural as can be, and we've taken all of the processing aids that we spoke about earlier out, and it's a beautiful natural product, they've achieved stability through other natural means, etc., etc., and then you start looking at the cost. No, wait a minute, hang on, if we take that out and put it, and that's where the compromises start. So I think that there is a disconnect between the product developer, which is a pure science and artistry or an artisanal view, and between the bean counters and the making of a business out of it. And I think if we can bring that closer and typically that means making use of your waste, because if you make use of your waste, you actually start making your product cheaper. And when you start making your product cheaper, there is room to maneuver in terms of keeping things au naturel. Education of the consumer to not want what they've got at the moment, and then the ability for us to use our raw materials more effectively or more efficiently, so that we have a product which can allow for the addition of costs due to business distribution channels.
Yeah, I think there's a great opportunity here for the entrepreneurial spirit, especially in this country where we feel we are always on the back foot or a couple of months behind the rest of the world. But the truth is, a lot of South African farmers can't afford pesticides to the extent that they are subsidized in the States or in Europe. I mean, I know Europe is limiting their use of pesticides more and more. But we have an opportunity here for the small farmer, the small food manufacturer to innovate and to find cost-effective ways of making this go further, because we don't have the big brother watchdog here when it comes to food, as much as they might have in America or in Australia, for example. So there's a good opportunity here to grab this and provide something better for you and make money out of it as well, and help our communities in so many ways. I think there should be more of an educational initiative as far as that is concerned. I know there are many initiatives going on where small producers can be certified organic production methods. There needs to be more of this, because we are desperate in this country, not only to change our health, not only to provide food to populations who are desperate and are on the poverty line. We've got more poverty here than most countries. So yeah, I think it's going to be up to the likes of yourself and like-minded companies to start getting us as a South African, not only the consumers, but producers, to the small people, to think differently.
I think that the history of South Africa has meant that the government's approach to farmers is possibly a little bit jaded. We don't have the support for farmers financially from government that we used to once upon a time enjoy in this country. And most other countries do provide. So they don't get rebates on their diesel, and they don't get a support when they're unable to produce a crop due to drought, COVID-19, whatever the emergency of the day might be, to keep them going. And we also took out the various food boards that we had, which were government employees. So they weren't making a profit. They were merely there to negotiate between the farmer and the retail industry. And so what happens now, you've got middle people who are in this value chain, who are businessmen and women, and they are making money out of that, which means that they are adding such a, they are buying up from the various farmers and then on selling to the retailers. And so the value chain has become so compacted that the cost to the consumer has become skewed. And at the end of the day, the retailer pushes back to the middleman pushes back to the farmer, and farmers are actually unable to make a decent living out of farming. That with the fact that farming is not sexy anymore, and this is not a South African issue, it's a global issue. Young people don't want to farm, they want to do tech things. So farming is becoming almost like a dying art in many respects. It's actually quite alarming to see how many farmers farmers' numbers are dropping around the world, just because son doesn't want to take or daughter doesn't want to take over anymore. So whilst we have this value chain which is so compacted, I think it must be almost impossible for any small farmer to try and make a stab into the market. And then we have this fixation with having the perfect tomato or the perfect carrot. It's the same nutrition whether it looks like that or like this, whether it's ugly looking or not. It doesn't matter. It's the same nutrition. But because the retailer doesn't want to have an ugly piece of fruit or vegetable on their shelf, they discard it. What most South Africans don't know, that we have a roundabout 51%. That means 510 kilograms out of every ton of crop grown doesn't leave the farm. Now that is not because it is a bad piece of fruit or vegetable. It means just because the middleman won't take it because the retailer won't take it. So that is being thrown away quite literally. And it's the same nutrition. Whether you eat a carrot that's ugly and you eat a carrot that's good looking, it's the same nutrition. And we are throwing that away.
And there's people starving and would do anything to feed their children off these products that are being buried.
That's actually why we developed a product which we use. It's a working name called Nourish, where we're actually able to take several different low value fruits and vegetables put together, because we're able to break them open in the way that we can with our technology. You can make this emulsion that is healthier than any amount of multivitamin pills you might want to take. It fills the stomach, and you've got something that'll actually make you healthy for less than your sort of $1.90, which I think is now the new breadline.
So, Roy, I'm going to put all of your contact details into the show notes, and we are going to distribute our conversation through the usual channels. I think what you're doing is absolutely crucial to the longevity and health of humanity, especially in this country. And thank goodness that there are companies like yours, and there's people like you who think that there's a better way to do this just by applying your mind and a bit of logic and common sense. And I think social responsibility. This is, you know, we should all be thinking about how our actions impact not only the earth but each other, because that's all we've got. Thank you so much for your time. And I can't wait to find out more and spread the word, because there are going to be people listening to this who want to find out more and who want to help. So let's get the word out there.
Thank you very much.
This episode has yet again been sponsored by Jackson's Real Food Market. If you are looking for a way to get involved with helping those less fortunate, Jackson's Community Support Program, A Little Relief, is a great way to help provide poorer communities with real, nutritious foods. They have made it possible to help in so many ways. Please visit their Facebook page, Jackson's Real Food Market and Eatery, to find out how we can all help each other through the COVID crisis.